Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum on the worst weather day of the year. You all get gold stars for braving the ice and the snow to come out this morning. We appreciate it. This morning, it's my great pleasure to welcome on behalf of the Miller Center and the Charlottesville Committee on Foreign Relations, John Woodworth has worked very hard with me to entice Undersecretary Robert Joseph to Charlottesville. The job was made a little bit easier, I think, by the fact that Bob Joseph has two children who are undergraduates in the university, one third year and the other fourth year, and we're glad to have them with us too. Robert Joseph is serving as Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security. He started this appointment about 6 months ago, but he spent his career in the service of the United States. He was educated at St. Louis University and the London School of Economics, has a master's degree from the University of Chicago and his doctorate from Columbia University. He's taught at the Fletcher School at Tulane, and at Carleton College, and has worked in various posts in the government, starting with the Department of Defense and ending with this present appointment in the Department of State. Please join me in welcoming Robert Joseph.
Well, good morning, George. Thank you for that very kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be here and to participate in the Miller Center Forum. A forum that serves, I think, as a rather unique link among the local community, the University of Virginia, and the national policymaking process. As a member of the Bush administration's national security team, as a resident of Virginia, and yes, as a proud parent of two University of Virginia students, I particularly welcome the role and the importance of that link. What I'd like to do this morning is give you a brief overview of the policy that we are pursuing to counter the spread of weapons of mass destruction, talk about some of the tools that we are using, some of the results that we have achieved, and also some of the challenges that we face today in this context. For many years, this issue was considered to be rather arcane, a subject that is best left to functional specialists. This clearly is no longer the case. Today, the spread of weapons of mass destruction by rogue states such as North Korea and Iran, and by terrorists is, I think, widely recognized as the preeminent threat that we face as a nation and the preeminent threat that faces the international community more broadly. This recognition was evident in the earliest days of the Bush administration, when in his first national address on national security threats, the president emphasized that we must give the highest priority to combating WMD and missile proliferation. Given the complexity of the challenge, we began by fashioning what is the first truly national and comprehensive strategy for dealing with this set of threats. And within this strategy, we recognized at the outset that the starting point, the very initial line of defense, is to prevent proliferation from happening in the first place. And as a result, we have, as an administration, dramatically increased the resources that are devoted to precluding the acquisition of WMD-related materials and their delivery systems. However, we also understood that prevention will not always be successful. And so we've placed a new and needed emphasis on protecting ourselves from these threats, as well as responding to the use of these weapons if they are employed against us or our forces or our friends and allies. We're building counterproliferation capabilities from missile defense to the better capability to detect and protect against the use of chemical weapons against us, in order to deter and defend against and defeat weapons of mass destruction in the hands of our enemies. And we're acquiring the capability to contain and reduce the potentially horrific effects of these weapons if they're used against us In terms of reducing casualties and other costs, such as from biological attacks against our population centers. To succeed in our effort to combat WMD proliferation, we must apply all tools of national power: diplomatic, economic, intelligence, law enforcement, and military. And I would like to just briefly talk about how we're applying these tools in the fight against proliferation, beginning with diplomacy. The Bush administration has given new vitality to the use of diplomatic tools to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. U.S. assistance to eliminate weapons and sensitive materials in other countries, such as through the well-known Nunn-Lugar-type programs, has been placed at record funding levels. Moreover, with the formulation in 2002 of the G8 Global Partnership Against the Spread of Weapons and Materials of Mass Destruction, the United States has successfully called on other states in the international community to pay their fair share of the burden in addressing this threat. This is, after all, a global threat, and it is a global responsibility to respond to it. This little recognized partnership among the G8 has added over $7 billion in commitments of non-U.S. funding for the goal of securing and eliminating sensitive WMD weapons and technologies. While the bulk of U.S. non-proliferation assistance does remain focused on the states of the former Soviet Union and primarily in Russia, we've also expanded our efforts to address proliferation threats more broadly. Landmark programs include the Global Threat Reduction Initiative, which is designed to reduce fissile and radioactive material anywhere in the world. The second line of defense and megaports programs, which provide for capabilities in ports and airports and land crossings for detecting the movement of radiological materials. And redirection programs, retraining programs, if you will, in Libya and Iraq to provide alternative employment for scientists and engineers who have been involved in weapons of mass destruction programs in those countries. The United States has also spearheaded the effort for the UN Security Council to take on its responsibilities to maintain peace and security against WMD threats. A major milestone in this context was the passage in April of last year of Security Council Resolution 1540. In adopting this resolution, the Security Council, really for only the second time since its founding, invoked Chapter 7 authorities to require nations to act to protect the peace against a general as opposed to a specific threat. In particular, 1540 requires all states legally to prohibit WMD proliferation activities, such as we witnessed with the AQCON one-stop shopping network for nuclear materials. And it further requires that states institute effective export controls and enhance security for nuclear materials on their territory. The United States has also led the way to strengthen the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA's, ability to detect nuclear proliferation, such as in Iran. We instituted a successful effort to increase that agency's budget. We have strongly supported the agency's additional protocol, which will strengthen its ability to uncover clandestine nuclear programs in many states. The President submitted our own additional protocol to the Senate, which gave its advice and consent last year, and the President has called upon other states to do the same. The President has also successfully urged the creation of a new special committee within the IAEA Board of Governors that will examine ways to strengthen that agency's ability to verify safeguards. In addition to the President's proposals to strengthen the IAEA institutionally, he has challenged the international community to rectify what is, in fact, the greatest weakness of the nuclear non-proliferation regime. And this is the ability of states, again, such as North Korea and Iran, to pursue nuclear weapons under the cover of a peaceful nuclear energy program. The lesson of Iran and North Korea is clear. Some states will cynically manipulate the provisions of the nuclear non-proliferation treaty to acquire sensitive technologies to enable them to pursue a nuclear weapons capability, the very capability that the treaty is designed to deny. To close this loophole, the president has proposed that uranium enrichment and plutonium separation, which are the two principal paths to acquiring fissile material for nuclear weapons, be limited to those states that already operate full-scale functioning facilities. In return, he called on the world's nuclear fuel suppliers to assure fuel supply in a reliable and cost-effective manner to those states which are willing to forgo enrichment and reprocessing. Next week, I'll meet with the other fuel provider states and with Dr. Alberti, the head of the IAEA, to advance our work to put in place assurances that will convince states with power reactors that their best economic interest is not to invest in expensive and proliferation-risky fuel cycle capabilities. And if we can succeed, I think this will be a major step forward in terms of our non-proliferation goals. Economic sanctions are another valuable tool of our overall effort to combat proliferation. We never, of course, take such action lightly, but we do intend to fully implement the laws. Several laws and executive orders provide for economic penalties against individuals or entities that provide proliferation-related materials and equipment to proliferators. And over the past decade, the United States has imposed sanctions on many different entities in over 20 countries. When necessary, we will also request and compel the United Nations Security Council to adopt and enforce sanctions in the most dangerous proliferation cases. Adopting many of the tools developed in the war against terrorism, we are also working with our partners to cut off financial flows that fuel proliferation. Security Council Resolution 1540 requires states to take and enforce effective controls on funds and services related to export and transshipment that would contribute to WMD programs. Consistent with this resolution, in July of this year, G8 leaders called for enhanced efforts to combat proliferation through cooperation to identify and track and freeze financial transactions and assets associated with proliferation-related activities. President Bush augmented U.S. efforts in this area when he issued this past July a new executive order, which authorizes us to freeze assets and block transactions of persons or entities or their supporters that are engaged in proliferation. Currently, 16 entities, 11 from North Korea, 4 from Iran, and 1 from Syria, have been designated under the order, and we are actively considering additional ones to be added. Our efforts to combat proliferation can also be aided by other financial tools that are not specifically intended to stop WMD. For example, in September, the Treasury Department applied authorities under the Patriot Act against an Asian bank that provides financial services to North Korea's illicit activities, such as counterfeiting and drug trafficking. In designating this bank, Banco Delta Asia, as a primary source of laundering concern under the Patriot Act, Treasury acted to protect U.S. financial institutions while warning the global community of the illicit financial threat posed by this bank. We refer to another set of tools in our fight against proliferation as defensive measures. A key requirement of counterproliferation is to protect ourselves against WMD armed adversaries. Combating WMD requires both offensive and defensive capabilities, and to be successful, we must bring the full range of those capabilities to bear. One element of the solution set is missile defense, as well as improved counterforce and passive defense capabilities, together with capabilities that allow us to eliminate adversary WMD and manage the consequences of any attack. Still, other defensive measures are dual use. Dual use capabilities, as you know, have been long considered proliferation problems. But dual-use capabilities can be part of the solution. For example, the same disease surveillance and medical countermeasure responses required for public health protection against infectious diseases are critical for defending against biological weapon attacks. Perhaps one of the most important defensive measures undertaken by the Bush administration to combat weapons of mass destruction is the Proliferation Security Initiative, or PSI, which shows, I think, the very close interaction among and the creative use of diplomatic, military, intelligence, and law enforcement tools to combat proliferation. PSI countries have put all of these tools to work in a multinational yet very flexible fashion. The participating countries are applying books, are applying laws that are already on the books in innovative ways, and they're cooperating as never before to actually interdict shipments and to disrupt proliferation networks and to hold accountable the front companies that support them. PSI has now expanded to include support from more than 70 countries and continues to grow. It is not the traditional treaty-based approach to nonproliferation involving long, ponderous negotiations that yield results only slowly, if at all. Instead, it is a very active, a very proactive partnership of states that are committed to deterring and disrupting and preventing WMD proliferation, and it is working. The most dramatic successes of the Bush administration's comprehensive approach to WMD proliferation have been the dismantlement of the AQCON network and Libya's elimination of its chemical and nuclear weapons program, as well as its longer-range missile capabilities. Success in both of these cases required the application of all of the tools that I have mentioned, including diplomacy, including force, including intelligence. Intelligence penetration, in fact, of the AQCON network gave us knowledge of a shipment that was occurring in September of 2003 of thousands of centrifuge parts that were bound for the Libyan program aboard a German ship, the BBC China. PSI cooperation took place at that time between the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, and Italy, and resulted in the diversion of this ship and the seizure of its deadly cargo. The interdiction of the BBC China, followed by cooperation from the United Arab Emirates, South Africa, Malaysia, Turkey, and a number of European countries, have led to the dismantlement of the AQCON network and the ongoing investigation, prosecution, and imprisonment of many of its leading members, something we consider necessary both as a form of punishment, but probably even more importantly as a means of deterring others from getting into this, what was a very lucrative business for Dr. Khan. In turn, just 2 months after the BBC China interdiction, Libya in December of 2003 announced its historic decision to eliminate its WMD programs and longer-range missile capabilities. Why Libya would give up these capabilities is an important question and is the subject of a great deal of revisionist history, particularly on the part of individuals who were neither knowledgeable nor involved in the activities. There were a number of motivations in play at the time. One motivation was clearly the desire to end U.S. sanctions against the Libyan regime and to end its isolation. Libya had reached out prior to deciding to eliminate its weapons of mass destruction with a settlement with the families of the victims of Pan Am 103 and was clearly moving in the right direction. But the end of sanctions alone cannot explain why Libya took the decision that it did, a very difficult decision involving eliminating weapons programs that cost literally hundreds of millions of dollars and provided a important security element, at least in the context of the views of many in their elite. Other motivations included a growing feeling by Gaddafi that WMD programs were bringing costs and risks that far outweighed the gains that they would give him. This was, I think, the direct consequence of the president's policies and actions that together made very clear to the Libyan leadership that the U.S. was serious about combating weapons of mass destruction. There is no question that the Libyans felt that they were next on the list following Iraq, and they were concerned about regime survival. Another motivation related to this was the deployment of U.S. and coalition forces to Iraq. The Libyans approached us through intelligence channels to talk about weapons of mass destruction in March of 2003, at the very time we were flowing hundreds of thousands of forces into the region to enforce UN Security Council resolutions on Iraq WMD. Another motivation, as I mentioned, was the interdiction of the ship, the BBC China, which disrupted the supply line for the Libyan nuclear weapons program. And also, by exposing that program, changed Libyan calculations in terms of whether or not, or more accurately, the likelihood of a U.S. attack on Libya. Even more interesting, but I think less recognized, are two additional motives. I happened to have the opportunity to conduct the negotiations with the Libyans before they became public, before the public announcement in December of 2003. In fact, I was the only policy representative that dealt with them. And it was very interesting that, in addition to the motives that I have outlined, that they also talked about other things that they were concerned about. One, which was somewhat surprising to me, was their concern over the threat of Islamic fundamentalism. They considered their regime to be a target of Islamic extremism, and they actually wanted to reach out and work with us on counterterrorism, and they have since done that. And also, there was an underlying sense of legacy, of Gaddafi's legacy. I attended a meeting in Libya this past July, and when you go there, it is a dilapidated country. They have billions of dollars of money in reserve, but the sanctions and the isolation over the course of many years have really created a situation in which they don't seem to have the forward-looking state of mind among their people. And there was a concern. Pan-Africanism and these goals of a Pan-African movement led by Libya didn't pan out. The Pan-Arabism movement that Gaddafi tried to inspire didn't pan out. There was a sense that they were going nowhere and that they had to make a fundamental change. And they did. Again, a very difficult decision. But I think there are a number of lessons learned that we can take from that. And if you like, we can get into those when I finish with the prepared remarks. Let me just say that in the months after Libya's announcement, after its decision, Tripoli worked with us and with the British to disclose fully its weapons of mass destruction and missile efforts, and to eliminate those weapons and equipment. And in return, the United States has lifted many economic and political sanctions on Libya, paving the way for benefits for the Libyan people. Libya has been established, I believe, as a sound and more appropriate model for other proliferators. Give up your weapons of mass destruction programs and receive the benefits of being in good standing in the international community. Now let me just turn to the three proliferation challenges. The first is to end the North Korean and Iranian nuclear weapons programs. There should be no doubt that these countries have such programs. President Bush has made clear that while all options are on the table, our strong preference is to address these threats through diplomacy. And in the six-party talks, and specifically in the joint statement that was agreed this past September, North Korea committed to abandoning all of its nuclear weapons and existing nuclear programs. This was a notable development, but we still must agree on and implement the detailed requirements of North Korean denuclearization and its verification. And this task will certainly be a very difficult one. Indeed, North Korea's demand for a light water reactor, in contrast to the joint statement, underscores the difficulties ahead with North Korea. And most recently, following a brief session of the fifth round this last month, Pyongyang indicated that it may boycott further negotiations until the United States rescinds what North Korea calls economic sanctions against it. We have made clear that while we are committed to promoting the success of the six-party talks, we have no choice but to take those defensive measures that are necessary to ensure our own protection from the proliferation actions of North Korea, as well as from its illicit activities, including its money laundering and counterfeiting. In some ways, the challenge that Iran poses to the nuclear non-proliferation regime is even more daunting and more complex than the North Korean threat. Although the evidence, including nearly 20 years of hiding sensitive nuclear activities, clearly indicates a weapons program, Iran continues to argue that its work is entirely peaceful. In September, the IAEA board formally found Iran in non-compliance with its safeguards obligations, and this finding requires a report to the UN Security Council. The Council, in our view, will not replace the IAEA effort, but will reinforce it, for example, by providing additional authorities to the agency to pursue its investigation of Iran's nuclear activities. We continue to work with other IAEA members on the timing and content of the report of Iranian noncompliance. And we continue to support the efforts of the Germans and the British and the French, the so-called EU3, to find a negotiated solution. We're also working, in addition to the Europeans, with Russia and India and China and other countries to form an increasingly united coalition to block Iran's efforts. And at the last IAEA board meeting on Thanksgiving Day, we decided to support the request of the EU3 to defer for a short period of time the report to the Security Council. While we believe that we had a majority of the votes, we thought it best to seek an even broader international grouping to pressure Iran to return to the negotiations on the basis of the original terms. And those terms include no uranium conversion, which is occurring in Iran today and is a significant proliferation step on their part. Our patience is not infinite. Iran's continued pursuit of nuclear weapons is a danger to all of us, and absent a verified change of course in Iran, including a return to the negotiations and full cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency, we believe that very little additional time can pass before we must report Iran to the Security Council and take further steps. The second challenge is to end the proliferation trade by both rogue states and individuals and groups. As I described, we have made significant progress in the last few years. We've moved from the creation of international export control standards to their active enforcement through enhanced national legislation, PSI interdictions, international law enforcement, and financial cooperation. We've shut down the world's most dangerous proliferation network. More and more states are participating and endorsing PSI. Most recently, Jordan has added its commitments to this initiative. In October, I traveled to Central Asia to secure broader support for and participation in PSI. Central Asian states now have almost unanimously endorsed this initiative and are prepared to take action to ensure that their airspace will not be abused by proliferators. Given these states' geographic location as a crossroads for proliferation, particularly the ballistic missile trade between North Korea and Iran, the strong stance of the Central Asian governments will further complicate the actions of the principal state proliferators. Similarly, we are working with Singapore, Japan, and Australia to broaden PSI participation in Asia. These participants not only understand the global dangers posed by proliferation, but fully grasp the need to participate in this initiative for their own national economic security. We've had considerable success in PSI, steadily reducing the opportunities available to proliferators. But we must continue to expand and deepen our efforts using all available national and international authorities, and when necessary, creating new ones until the proliferation trade has been effectively ended. The final challenge that I would mention is the need to prevent terrorist acquisition and use of weapons of mass destruction, and especially biological and nuclear weapons. If terrorists acquire these weapons, they are likely to employ them, with potentially catastrophic effects. Deterrence simply may not apply in the context of terrorist use. A well-organized terrorist group with the appropriate technical expertise could probably create a crude nuclear device once it had the fissile material necessary for such a device. On the biological weapon side, with today's dual-use capabilities and access to particular pathogens, some of which occur naturally, the bioterror challenge presents a low-cost means of a potentially high-impact attack. Many of the tools we have in place to combat proliferation by states are relevant against WMD terrorism. A few examples are reducing the global stocks of fissile material and securing those that remain, improved nuclear and biological detection capabilities, and the interdiction of illicit traffic in nuclear and biological materials. A key difference, however, is one of scale. We cannot rest as long as enough material for even one nuclear weapons remain unsecured and vulnerable to terrorist possession. While many of the tools are the same, preventing WMD terrorism requires different approaches from those we have followed against state programs or against the conventional or non-WMD-related type terrorism. Intelligence collection, for example, and intelligence action against the two have in the past been quite different. With anti-terrorism, intelligence focused on individual groups, and anti-WMD intelligence focused on state programs. We are working very hard to close the gap in our collection and analysis of intelligence so that we can understand and counteract the WMD terrorist threat. As with countering state programs, we also require sustained strategic approaches, national and multinational, to combat WMD terrorism. We will work with our international partners to harness all relevant resources to establish more coordinated and effective capabilities to prevent and protect against and respond to the threat of WMD terrorism. This is an issue that I am confident you will be hearing a great deal about in the future. Let me just conclude by noting that the strategic approach to combating WMD proliferation, which the President laid out over 4 years ago, continues to provide a guide to action against this preeminent threat. Our strategy and the new measures we have adopted to implement it, the new tools that I have described, are flexible and dynamic. They're suited to the changing nature of the proliferation threat. We have accomplished much, but we have much more to accomplish in the future. Why don't I stop there and take your comments and questions? Thank you.
John Woodworth has been sort of serving as co-host today. John, would you like to open the discussion?
Well, call
me up there. let Chi Lam give you the microphone.
Oh, okay. Well, Bob, one area that I've had a particular interest in is Iran, and I was just wondering what you see. You are able to discuss that, but can you add anything to what you foresee coming up, and what the consequences of Iranian intractability might be? I realize there obviously you can't say certain things, and certain things aren't decided anyway. But do you have any sense for that, and where you see this going, and how we might need to react?
I had the opportunity to talk to a small group of individuals yesterday, including Henry Kissinger and Harold Brown and a number of previous cabinet members. It was a very small group, but a very interesting set of individuals. And I laid out my views on North Korea, Iran, and WMD terrorism. North Korea is a hard case. It's a very difficult problem. If it wasn't a very difficult problem, it would have been resolved a long time ago. But North Korea compared to Iran is easy. Iran is more complex. Iran is, and Kissinger agreed with this 100%, is more dangerous than North Korea. North Korea says it has nuclear weapons. North Korea probably does have those capabilities. North Korea is assessed to have ballistic missile capabilities that could deliver nuclear weapons. But North Korea is an isolated country. It's a country that I believe we can defend against, and we can perhaps succeed in the diplomatic context. Iran is much different. As some of us say, Iran is a real country. Iran has tremendous resources. Human resources in terms of their scientific and technical capabilities, financial resources. Iran is also motivated not by a desire to stay isolated, which is how North Korea protects its own regime. It desires to be isolated. Iran, on the other hand, has a very ambitious agenda, a very aggressive agenda that is motivated by the ideology of its leadership, an ideology that is becoming more and more apparent with every statement made by the new president of Iran, such as wiping Israel off of the face of the map. He also said he was going to wipe the United States off the face of the map, but it is a very aggressive regime that is determined to acquire a nuclear weapons capability. We see that because Iran has crossed every previous red line. The last red line that it crossed was conversion, which I mentioned. In August, Iran resumed the conversion of uranium to produce UF6, which is what you put into centrifuges, which is what you use to develop the enriched uranium for a nuclear weapon. The reaction of the international community was to pass the by majority vote. For the first time, it wasn't done by consensus, but by majority vote, the IAEA resolution in September that I mentioned, finding Iran in non-compliance. But there haven't been any consequences. We've withheld moving the issue to the Security Council in order, as I said, to get more support, not just from the EU3, but from Russia and China, because if you're going to have this in the Security Council, you're going to want Russia and China to at least be in a position where they won't block action. And there is now only one more red line. Now, I'm sure the Iranians, in classic Iranian bargaining fashion, will create pink line after pink line in the context of this red line of enrichment. But once they begin to enrich, that is the point of no return. And 2 days ago, their nuclear negotiator said that Iran would reject any arrangement that did not provide for enrichment in Iran. And so they have said that they are determined to move forward. The key issue is, will the international community be able to come together the way we're trying to bring it together to impose sanctions on Iran? Because the Iranian government would feel, I think, the pain of sanctions. Now, it may not be enough to convince them to delay their program any further or to dismantle their program. We will see. But it is, I think, the only path forward diplomatically, at least the only path that I see. Now, there are other things that we also have to do, just like with North Korea. If negotiations don't work, we have to be prepared to deter the threat and to defend against it. And we need to do the same with Iran. But Iran will be much more difficult to deter, to defend, and it's much more important that we find a diplomatic solution.
Fred Hitz.
Ambassador Joseph, I'm just taking off on John's point. The psychological hooks that you were able to identify with respect to Libya, as you try that effort against Iran and North Korea, do you see any kinds of possibilities? This point that you made about Libya letting them get back into the mainstream of relations with nations. My problem with the Iran thing, quite frankly, is how do you argue that Iran has no right to have enrichment facilities given the fact that Pakistan and India, their very close neighbors, already do? Why not us? I can hear them saying. But thank you.
Well, just on your last point, and then I'll spend a few minutes on the lessons learned from Libya and how they may or may not apply to other proliferators. Pakistan and India, of course, never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran signed that treaty and agreed that it would not pursue a nuclear weapons capability. It gave up that right in signing the treaty. Iran does not have the right, no state that is a non-nuclear weapons state party to the NPT has the right to enrich or reprocess for weapons purposes. But I think this is best not discussed in the context of theoretical rights. Iran doesn't claim it has a right to a nuclear weapon. It claims it has the right to peaceful nuclear energy. And it claims that its enrichment program is designed to provide fuel for the reactors that it intends to build. We know this isn't the case. We know Iran is pursuing weaponization. And that is another issue that we are working very closely with our European, Russian, and other friends. In terms of the lessons learned from the Libya experience, I left government in November with no intention of ever returning to government service. I had about 5 months before I returned to government service. And in those 5 months, I worked actually on a book about the Libya experience. And one part of that effort is to identify lessons learned. I mean, why did Libya do this? And how can we benefit from the understanding of their motivations and the tactics that we pursued in order to try to convince other countries that may be in the proliferation business to not progress with their programs? The first lesson learned, and there are lessons that are both strategic and tactical. The first lesson learned is a strategic one, and that is you need to demonstrate that you are serious about stopping proliferation. And I think this administration clearly has done that. And that had a major impact on the Libyan leadership. Also, in the strategic category, I would say that in dealing with states like Libya or Iran or North Korea, you've got to insist on what we called a strategic decision. When the Libyans sat down across the table from me, they said, let's talk about lifting sanctions. In other words, let's bargain this. Let's trade X for Y. Our response was, we don't want that. That's not what we want. We're not here to bargain. We will make it clear that if you eliminate your weapons of mass destruction program, you will remove a major obstacle in our relationship. And this will increase the prospects for dropping sanctions and for improving commercial and political and other ties that will benefit the Libyan people. But that's not what we're here to do. We're not here to bargain. We're here to get your agreement that there will be a complete removal and complete elimination of all WMD and longer range missiles. It wasn't X for Y. And had we done that, I'm absolutely convinced to this day that we would never have gotten the clean outcome that we got. Because remember that literally hundreds of tons of equipment of Libya's nuclear program were removed. It's now sitting in Tennessee rather than in Libya. All of their longer range missiles were removed. All of their chemical munitions were destroyed in country. And we're about to eliminate the chemical agent. So you've got to have, I think, a strategic decision. Another lesson learned was the need to employ all of our tools, as I mentioned in my prepared remarks, diplomatic tools, intelligence tools. I mean, the Libya story is an incredible intelligence success story, I think. And also interdiction and force. They all played a role in convincing the Libyans to give up their weapons of mass destruction. I mentioned the timing of the Libyans approaching us. It's the same time that we're sending forces into the theater for Iraq. I don't believe in coincidences, but there's another very important time in the Libya story, and that is the time of the BBC China. The Libyans came, as I said, to us in March of 2003. Between March of 2003 and the beginning of October in 2003, we had a number of very brief discussions in intelligence channels, but the discussions really didn't go anywhere. It was a request on our part to come in to bring our experts into Libya so that we could have some confidence in what we saw and what we would learn about the programs. And it was the Libyans basically saying, well, we'll get back to you. The Libyans never came to us and said, we have all of these weapons programs, we want you to come and pick them up. That wasn't how this played out. It was only when we actually took the evidence off of the BBC China, We took the photographs of the centrifuge parts to the Libyans in October that they allowed us to send our experts in. And it was only then that you had the unraveling of the program. And it was only after that that you had the strategic decision made by Colonel Gaddafi, a voluntary decision, but a difficult decision, I'm sure. Another lesson learned that I think needs to be thought about in the Iran context is the need to create the perception of a win-win. When we dealt with the Libyans, it was never in an imperial sort of fashion. We weren't treating them as a defeated country. And we recognized from the beginning that if this was to work, and if this was to produce a second model for other proliferators to follow, the Libyans would have to look at this decision as a win for them as well. Clearly, it was a win for us on the non-proliferation side. Okay, this is a major non-proliferation victory by any standards, probably the greatest non-proliferation victory that one can point to. The trick was making it a win for the Libyans. And here it was affecting their calculus with regard to the benefit or the cost of having WMD programs. And when Colonel Gaddafi made his announcement, he actually said that their calculation had changed, that these weapons no longer contributed to the security of Libya. And that's where we'd like to get to with other countries. There are a number of other lessons learned, probably on the tactical side, that we would have to, I think, insist on in any dealings with Iran or other countries. One, of course, was to ensure secrecy. In the context of the Libya case, very, very few people knew about this. The intelligence community has a different culture. There were a number of intelligence officials that were involved and played an instrumental role in this. But on the policy side, you could count the number of people on one hand that were involved in this. Had this become more widely known in the policy community, it would have, I guarantee you, leaked. And had this leaked, there is no way that I think Colonel Gaddafi could have made the decision that he did. Because giving up these programs not only meant giving up programs, as I said, that cost literally hundreds of millions of dollars, but affected the careers of many people, both in the scientific community, but also in the military community. The mobilization of opposition, both internally within Libya, as well as externally within the region, I think would have precluded the outcome that we did. So I could go on and on about lessons. As you see, I've thought quite a bit about it, but let me just stop there. I think some of these lessons are applicable to Iran. Others are not. All of these cases are unique. Iran is different from North Korea. North Korea is different from Libya. They're all different from WMD terrorism. But we need to work with all of the tools and elements that we've got.
Sir.
Do you think there's any chance of reunification of North and South Korea?
Well, I think the chances are 100%. The issue is one of timing. There is a great concern, actually, of the implosion of North Korea. The Chinese are very concerned about millions of North Koreans coming into their country if that government were to fall. The South Koreans are very concerned about the implosion of the North and look at the costs that were associated with the unification of Germany. My sense is that this regime in the North cannot last that much longer. How much longer it does last will be in part dependent upon how much assistance it gets from the outside, including from South Korea and China, but also other parties. It is a regime that has no future, I would argue. And if you look at the economic bankruptcy of that regime, if you look at their treatment of their own population in terms of human rights and the abhorrent treatment of their own people, I don't think it's got much of a future.
2-part question, sir. Could you comment on the apparent inconsistency of acquiescing to the Brazilian enrichment program which is considerably further down the road than the Iranian, and objecting to the Iranian? And secondly, could you comment on the recent agreement with India, which many feel is one of the most historic turns in our nonproliferation policy and has caused bipartisan concern?
Sure. Let me just take India first. In July, as many of you know, the president signed a joint statement with the Prime Minister of India when the Prime Minister visited here. And one major aspect of that joint statement was the agreement to seek greater cooperation on civil nuclear projects, something that we have not done with India because India has been outside of the non-proliferation regime. It is our calculation that the steps that India agreed to take in the context of that joint statement, the non-proliferation steps it agreed to take, on balance present a gain for us by bringing India into the non-proliferation mainstream. India, in that context, for example, agreed to separate its civilian and military facilities and to apply international safeguards on the civilian side. We believe this is significant from a non-proliferation perspective if the plan that India puts forward on this is credible and defensible from a non-proliferation perspective. India also agreed to follow the procedures and regulations and guidelines of the Nuclear Supplier Group, which deals with the export of nuclear technology. India agreed to continue its moratorium on testing. India agreed to support the negotiation of a fissile material cutoff treaty. Now, we wanted more. We wanted an actual cutoff, but India wasn't willing to do that in the context of the negotiations. As we look at the commitments that India makes, we believe that it does move it into the mainstream. India has been at war with the NPT for 25 years. And what we want is India's cooperation on non-proliferation. It has a good record. It's getting an even better record. And after the July agreement, I mentioned the September board meeting of the IAEA, India, which surprised many people, voted with us to find Iran in non-compliance. That was a significant step. The concerns that have been expressed, and they have been on both sides of the aisle, as has support on both sides of the aisle, the concerns about this program are deal are understandable. But I think you've got to look at this arrangement in the context of India as an emerging strategic power, India as an emerging partner of ours in the future, India as a location for the expansion of nuclear power in terms of energy. I think overall it is a good deal for us. And as I said, and I certainly don't oversell it, but as I said, it is, in my view, a non-proliferation plus. And I think that there are many that agree with that. But there are concerns that have been expressed, including by many who have been involved in the nuclear non-proliferation community for a long time. In terms of the differences between Brazil and Iran, Brazil, of course, is further along. In fact, Brazil has a functioning enrichment capability. And when the president tried to draw that line in order to say that there should be no further transfer of technologies associated with enrichment and reprocessing, we had to draw it somewhere, and we drew it at those states that currently have this type of capability, a fully functioning capability that includes IAEA safeguards. Iran doesn't have that. And Iran and Brazil, quite frankly, are not the same in terms of the types of proliferation risks and threats that we face. So all of these countries are different.
On Tuesday of this coming week, Dr. Fred Hayden who is involved in the worldwide fight to stop the spread of bird flu. We'll be here at 11 o'clock next Friday, a week from today. Jan Crawford Greenberg, who covers the Supreme Court for the Chicago Tribune and is a regular commentator on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, will be here to discuss the confirmation of the next Supreme Court justice. Those who are interested in some of the matters raised by Undersecretary Joseph today will want to put on their calendars that on the 30th of January, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury Stuart Levy will be here. He runs or is in charge of the office that's interdicting flows of financing to terrorists. And then in February, I believe it's the 20th of February, Laura Secor, who wrote the long piece on Iran in the New Yorker of 2 weeks ago, will be here to talk about her recent visits to Iran. Please join me in thanking Secretary Robert Joseph.
Thank you all.